is Hazel Kahn, and this is North Fork Works. Today my guest is Diana Gordon. She lives in Greenport. She's just written a book, Village of Immigrants, Latinos in an Emerging America, and was published in November last year by Rutgers University Press. You're not called Diana, really.
Yes, I've been Dinny all my life to anyone I've met or who has met me more than once. But of course, professionally, I write as Diana. And this is a professional departure for me, this book, because it's not an academic book. Right. I'm a retired political science professor from the City University of New York. And my previous books were all much more theoretical or analytical than this book. But this book has a very special place in my heart because it's a book about the village that I now live in, and it deals with a subject that, in fact, I didn't pay any attention to or significant attention to when I was a working professor.
When I read the book, there were things that surprised me, and one was that immigrants come to small towns. One always thinks of them more in, you know, large towns. And the other thing that surprised me was that in Greenport, one-third of the population is, in fact, Latino.
When you look back at the census for 1990, there are no Latinos there except a few Puerto Ricans. So everybody who's come in the last 20, 25 years, pretty much, is an immigrant. But the village is unusual in Suffolk County, and I would say in Long Island, although there are others where there are very high proportions of Latino immigrants. But it's not so terribly unusual in some other parts of the country. And that's something that I discovered only as I was doing the research on my own town.
Which parts of the country are there? Are there similar?
Particularly Midwestern states, which are largely agricultural. Mm. Iowa is a very interesting example. There are many small towns in Iowa that are very heavily populated by Latino immigrants, and they are towns which have been in decline as the American small town, the iconic American small town, really is no more as it was in the 19th and early 20th century. And the decline of the American small town is very evident in most of the Middle West. But in Iowa, you see many small towns which are being revitalized by the arrival of the immigrants. And that's by and large because agriculture, large-scale agriculture, tends to need workers who are no longer available in those small towns and for prices that Americans generally will not take for their labor. So the gap has been filled by Latino immigrants. One of the consequences of writing this book is that I'm now very interested in the possible revival of many small towns in the United States. And I'm looking around to see what are the characteristics of other small towns that have been revitalized. And having a large nearby agricultural sector is very important. But also, if the town is near an area which is appealing to visitors for one reason or another, whether it's in Oregon, where there are beautiful trails nearby, or other maritime areas where there are possibilities for tourists or second homeowner retirees. Greenport has amenities that appeal to people who don't live there. And that's true, I think, of a number of these other small towns.
In other words, when visitors come, they need all kinds of things, like hotels and restaurants and things like that. And those hotels and restaurants need workers.
And the people who decide to retire there or who are going to have second homes there need landscapers and cleaning ladies and restaurants and the things you mentioned.
Right. So Greenport, in fact, has been revitalized.
Oh, yes.
It was in pretty dire straits, Greenport, at some stage of its...
Yes. There was a huge influx of immigrants in the late 19th and early 20th century. Greenport had always been a lively little place which attracted weekenders and others from outside the village in the 19th century. So it was a very lively little place and very active in maritime pursuits of various mm-hmm. kinds. It was a very small, modest whaling port, for instance, in the middle of the 19th century. But in the middle of the 20th century, it became known for building boats that were used for the Second World War. And it had government contracts for submarine chasers, for example, which were built in this little town. But then after the war, of course, those contracts were gone. There was a real mass out-migration. I think one of the reasons that the arrival of the Latino immigrants in the 1990s and 2000s has been relatively peaceful compared to much of Suffolk County, is that there's a sort of institutional memory of the last big wave of immigration, which occurred in the late 19th and early 20th century. They remember what their grandparents went through.
Therefore they were relatively receptive, relatively benign, well, or benevolent, or was
yes.
that overstating
I think,
it?
No, I think benign is a good word. There's a caution about acceptance and absorption of this population. But the population is badly needed now, and I think that's at the core of acceptance of the immigrants. So after a couple of decades, the end of the 70s was the nadir.
Oh, was it? Okay.
And the big restaurant, which had been a draw for New Yorkers from the city as well as from Nassau County, that restaurant burned. And that was a kind of symbolic marker for the troubles of Greenport. But with new grant monies and new projects, a beautiful marina, a wonderful carousel, the economy began to improve. And there were now lower level workers, some of them skilled, but many of them unskilled and undocumented. A lot of the labor was provided by this new immigrant group, and Mayor Capel says they've saved this town.
What was your plan for this book when you started?
I started by being curious, just curious about this population. I had lived in New York City for 45 years. I thought of myself as a city person. I was retiring to a small town which felt somehow like a small city. And I realized that part of that was because of the diversity. There are lots of black people in Greenport too, and there were all these Latinos. And so I was doing some volunteer work with the Latinos.
You speak Spanish?
Yes, not terribly well, but well enough. And I was working, doing very simple things with Sister Margaret Smythe, who is an activist nun who's, you know, tends to people up and down the North Fork.
I've interviewed her on this program.
Oh, good.
She's
a fantastic
woman.
She's terrific. And, you know, I would fill out applications for food stamps or registration documents for people whose children were entering school for the first time, things like that. And I got more and more interested. And, of course, the fact that I was working with Sister Margaret gave me a kind of authority. Authority is not the right word, perhaps a trustworthiness. Mm-hmm. And so I began just interviewing some of the people who came in to see Sister Margaret, and then they would suggest other people. And then the woman who had cleaned my house, who was already becoming a friend, through her I met other people. It was what social scientists call a snowball effect. It was very easy. I'm still stunned by how easy it was. People were eager to tell their stories. I always promised them that I would not use their real names. But once they knew that I was going to treat their stories with confidentiality and with respect, they were very eager to tell them. I have 7 portraits of the profiles of the immigrants that I interviewed in the book. But I probably interviewed a total of about 100 people, maybe 50 of them with some depth.
I was reading your book as the political climate was becoming more and more just revolting, frankly. Mm-hmm. And reading your book was such a counterpoint to the awful, the aspiring presidents of this country. So that's why the 7 profiles and the way the chapters are organized gives dimension to any individual, they become real people, as opposed to a number that people want to get rid of. You know, 11 million, we have to deport them. So here are these people living in the shadows. It's such a grim concept, but that is what everybody uses to refer to the immigrants, that they're these living and skulking and trying not to be noticed and, you know, always afraid, always afraid.
It is true that they're always afraid in the sense that there's this sort of looking over your shoulder to see whether a policeman will stop you for your broken tail light and discover that you're undocumented, for instance. That's one of the sources of fear. But there are many, many others. But it is not really true, at least in this little town, and I think in most little towns, and in some big cities which have sent out messages that are protective. I mean, a city like New York, you can be very comfortable in New York, unless you have serious criminal record.
I like the way you said it, the city kind of sends out messages in a sense.
Oh, yes.
What is that?
Well, New York City has a Department of Immigrant Affairs. I'm not absolutely sure that's the name of it, but there's a welcoming message that comes directly from City Hall and from the bureaucracy of the city. Of course, that's not perfect, but there's a real effort to provide language access for foreigners who need to do business with the city, to be able to contact city agencies and speak your language, things like that.
In Greenport, I got the impression from your book that there's also a lot of people in Greenport who are supportive of the Latino community.
In an informal way, yes. For instance, in 2007, there was a raid with which the Southold police cooperated. And they were looking for gang members, supposedly. And they didn't really find any gang members. But, you know, they took people out of their homes at early in the morning, leaving women and children, you know, a terrible situation. And Greenport and Southold residents complained vigorously about this. So there are definitely people who are supportive. There are also people who are not. I don't want to present too much of a Pollyanna picture of the atmosphere. But in general, I would say that Greenport is more accepting of its new immigrant population than is true in most of the rest of Suffolk County.
So would you say that's because actual mutual need?
Yes, I think that Greenport employers know they need the immigrants. They need them in the kitchens of the restaurants. Greenport is increasingly a destination for people looking for second or vacation homes. They need them for the landscaping tasks that go with a thriving, economically revitalizing community. So I think that's a very important aspect of why it has been a success. One of the things that made this book, as it is, with chapters about individuals and chapters about institutions, was that I began to see a kind of ecology in the village. You know, in biology, ecology is the relationship of organisms and the environment. And in sociology has sort of adopted this idea, looking at ecology as the relationship between individuals and the institutions that surround them or with which they interact. And I got interested in that aspect, not just the way that the immigrants are treated in the schools and on the job and by police, but also who they were and how they went about these interactions that they would have to have with the institutions of a small village. So that's why the book has both individual profiles, long chapters about the schools, the healthcare system.
And I like the way you said housing or houses. It's the difference between treating them as a number or as a person. Then cobbled care, I like that as well. That's somehow a healthcare system has grown up. Illegal, legal, I don't know. Cobbled care. And then dilemmas of control, and this is all the legal stuff. And then what's next? You actually say a small town model. And I took that as your suggestion for policy making in this town.
The suggestion is really at the policy level, we need to be figuring out what can revive small towns and to what extent a revival can involve immigrants.
Diana Gordon, resident of Greenport, is talking about her book, Village of Immigrants, Latinos in an Emerging America. This is Hazel Kahn on North Fork Works on WPKN Radio.
Since I've finished the book, what has interested me is trying to understand more about other villages and small towns, maybe up to, say, 25, 30, 50,000 people.
What is the population of Greenport?
2,200. Yeah. In 2010, it was 2,200. That's permanent residents. There are also part-timers.
These policy prescriptions for a small town. What is it that Greenport has and must have, and what it doesn't have yet but needs to have to make it a successful small town?
Well,
and what is a successful small town anyway?
I don't know what a successful small town really is. Several people have asked me what surprised you most as you looked at this small town, and it was the cobbled care. It was the fact that with all the defects of our American healthcare system, Greenport has managed to put together institutions and activities and people who care in such a way that most immigrants will find most of their health needs met in one way or another. That really did surprise me. It's done with great effort and agonizing lack of resources. So I think one of the successes has been that most immigrants get most healthcare needs addressed. But of course, what needs to happen to make it more stable and more secure is more resources, better coordination. And maybe that's going to come because we are now being introduced to the idea of the affiliation between the local hospital and Stony Brook with its international level of care.
The idea to develop care, cobbled or not, for immigrants, is that just to make sure that they're kept healthy and that they'll be working properly?
Sure. They continue to make the contributions that they're now making. And as their children, the Greenport schools have been filled up with immigrant children, and those children are going to be the future workers and voters and so forth of Greenport. I mean, one of the interesting questions is whether, like many American young people, they will flee the small town. I think the odds that young immigrant children will stay in Greenport is higher than it would be if they were American children because of the cultures from which they come. Of course, that cultural proclivity is eroded somewhat, but it's not gone.
What are the contributions that the immigrants make?
Well, there's the lowest level of less skilled workers who wash the dishes in the restaurants and clean people's houses and so forth. But there are other things too. Along Front Street, one of the two main streets of this tiny town, there's a store that everybody refers to as the Spanish store, which of course is not accurate, but you can buy banana leaves for your tamales, but you can also send your money back home. You can buy avocados that will be ready that evening instead of in the supermarket where they're hard and you have to save them for several days. There is a relatively new Mexican restaurant. It's almost next door to that is the Guatemalan restaurant. And there is a beauty parlor on each side of the street, one for men, one for women, owned differently. And then if you go down to the west a little bit, there's a little pupuseria where Salvadoran pupusas are delicious. For a while, there was an astrologer, but she has gone out of business. I don't know what happened to her. But there are five or six small businesses in a town of 2,100 people, 2,200.
But there's also probably landscape people that wouldn't have a storefront.
That's right. There are lots of landscapers. So there are many levels of contribution, of economic contribution.
People don't realize that these are also consumers. They are spending money. For every dollar that they earn, they're spending a dollar.
So taxpayers. I mean, there's nonsense about undocumented immigrants don't pay taxes. It's ridiculous, of course. They pay sales taxes, and many of them in Greenport pay income taxes through registering a tax ID, which is given by the federal government for people who do not have and can't get Social Security numbers.
Oh, really? Are they still considered undocumented?
Oh, yeah.
But they have ID?
Yes, issued by the federal government. And that's what they use to file their taxes. Not everybody does it. In my experience, those who've been here for a long time, after a while, they start wanting to pay taxes. You know, it may be in the first decade they're not paying income taxes, but they get their tax ID and they pay some back taxes and some and current taxes.
Is it that they just think it's the right thing to do or that they think it's a protection?
I think it's both. I think not a protection from immediate vulnerability of being deported, but protection in the event that at some point or other they can become legalized, they now have evidence that they have paid taxes. They have made a commitment to the country, and some just because they realize this is a contribution everyone else makes.
If the Latino immigrant population in Greenport, if it doesn't prosper and thrive, that without them this would be a sort of flat and boring and non-dimensional place. It wouldn't have color, it wouldn't have vibrancy. What does it take for Greenport to ensure the viability of the Latino population? And what will happen if it's not viable and they don't thrive?
Well, one of the things it takes to make it work in the longer term is for the children to be well educated. And the Greenport schools are doing their best, but they're terribly under-resourced. And I think that it's still an open question of whether the educational system is going to be enough to bring these kids into a comfortable middle-class life that is supported by the various opportunities in Greenport. We're lucky that we have the Suffolk County Community College nearby. Many of these immigrant children who are now reaching the end of public education are going there, doing well, transferring to Stony Brook in this, you know, after 2 years, that kind of thing. So I think that's one of the things that will have to happen.
It's also true that without these immigrant children, the schools might be moribund.
Absolutely. I think the Greenport schools are the only schools on the North Fork where population is not declining. And that's a sign of a dying place, not bringing young people into adult life in your community. The other thing, there has to be more rental housing. There have to be more housing opportunities in general for immigrants. And if I had to say a single thing that is a hazard right now, it would be the lack of affordable housing. But the prices are going up very fast. But it's also just the availability of spaces at all, because what's happening, some of those lovely old Victorian houses that were abandoned after World War II and turned into multiple dwellings are now being reconverted into single-family houses for second homeowners or affluent people coming to retire or use for Airbnb. But the second part of your question was, what happens if this doesn't work? And one of the things that will happen is that all these things that now the immigrants do for very little money, and they should be paid better, will now you have to spend much more money because they'll have to go west, live 50 miles away from their jobs. It will be much harder to sustain that lower level of the economy. There's a part of me that's not very sympathetic with a village that fills itself up with better houses and more affluent people at the cost of maintaining the community that has contributed a great deal to its revitalization.
If, in fact, they start living 50 miles away, then they will not be living in Greenport.
That's right.
And therefore, the flavor and the international and the diversity of the Greenport ecosystem will be reduced. It'll become, again, more like a monoculture.
That's right. One of the things that a number of us in the village have talked about is you don't want it to become like Sag Harbor. I actually think Sag Harbor is an absolutely lovely place, but It's very clean. It's very safe.
It's not very white.
Very interesting. It's very white.
Right.
Exactly. And there's a kind of vacuity at a certain point when everybody is from a certain slice of the upper middle class. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about the 1%, but maybe we're talking about the 5%. And I don't think Greenport would be nearly as vital or interesting a place if it were just occupied by the 5%.
You have many reasons for having written this book. Not least of it is that you live there.
Yes.
So that gave you a reason to explore it and to understand it. But now, is it also true that you think that by having written this book, you will in fact be maybe protecting that part of Greenport that you don't want to lose?
Well, I certainly hope so.
If people want to get your book, tell them what it's called and where they might get it.
If they're on the North Fork, they can go to Burton's Books in Greenport.
On Front Street.
On Front Street. But also it's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble online.
But of course we like independent booksellers.
As I mentioned earlier, I'm very interested now in understanding the phenomenon of small town immigration and in seeing what can be done to use this immigrant influx to help revive small towns more generally. So I've started a website called smalltownimmigration.com, and I have a few of my own articles and lots of links to other information about small towns and the fate of rural areas as regards immigrants.
So this is a happening area, is it? Academic or government
area? I don't think so. No. I don't think it's such a happening area, but the Department of Agriculture, the United States Department of Agriculture, for instance, has information on immigration in small towns. And
there's something very hopeful, something also very American about it. Mm-hmm. There's something like Phoenix rising out of the ashes about small towns. Mm-hmm. It's new blood coming in, and it's new stuff is happening in a country that's in very many ways declining, at least an infrastructure point of view.
Right. There's a phenomenon that immigration scholars refer to as the new destinations, that in the last decade, immigrants have moved beyond the border states and the coastal states into the center and other parts of the, and then into the south. That's been extraordinary, the movement of immigrants into the southern states in the last decade. And this is very new. And a part of that is the movement into small towns.
So now you're going to become the small town guru.
I hope so.
Let me know. Keep me posted. So thank you very much, Dini.
Thank you. I love doing this. It was a wonderful experience, and I would love to hear from some of your listeners.
Well, let's welcome them to contact you. So they would do that how?
Probably the easiest thing to do is to go to my website, smalltownimmigration.com, where you will find two different email addresses. I'm very interested in hearing from other people about small towns. In fact, I'm thinking about sending out a big note to librarians in small towns, asking them, tell me about your immigrants. Mm. Maybe your radio show will reach a few librarians about their small town.
When it's on my website, you can send them the link.
Good.
So thank you very much, and I look forward to continuing our conversation.
You heard Diana Gordon, Greenport resident, talking about her book, Village of Immigrants, Latinos in an Emerging America. You can hear North Fork Works on WPKN on the first Wednesday of each month. All previous programs are archived on hazelkahn.com. North Fork Works is produced by Tony Ernst.